Chapter 45 Verse 1 Joseph could no longer control himself. Now that they had passed his tests, Joseph was emotionally overcome by his brothers' presence, their suffering, their pain and his, and their moral growth. They were not the same people who had thrown him into a pit and then sat down to a meal while he cried out for help. Verse 1 continued, before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone withdraw from me." So there was no one else about when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Verse 2. His sobs were so loud that the Egyptians could hear, and so the news reached Pharaoh's palace. Verse 3. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still well?" Joseph spoke now without an interpreter, communicating directly with his brothers in their language. That, along with his knowledge that they were responsible for their lost brother's disappearance, next verse, made it impossible not to believe what would otherwise have been incredible. This Egyptian ruler was their brother. Verse 3 continued, but his brothers could not answer him. So dumbfounded were they on account of him. Dumbfounded is surely an understatement. The brothers were undoubtedly in a state of shock. They had assumed Joseph was either long dead, life expectancy for slaves in ancient societies was short, or had irretrievably disappeared. How could a 17-year-old boy who was presumably sold into slavery become, aside from Pharaoh, the most powerful person in Egypt? It made no sense. Yet here he was, undeniably the man he claimed to be. As the American writer Mark Twain once remarked, truth is stranger than fiction because fiction has to make sense. Verse 4, then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come forward to me." And when they came forward, he said, "I am your brother, Joseph." These words, "I am Joseph, your brother," were echoed by Pope John XXIII, whose given name was Joseph Roncalli, when he greeted Jewish leaders at the Vatican in 1960. The Pope used this great biblical story of reconciliation in an attempt to reconcile the Roman Catholic Church with the Jewish people, whom it had often persecuted. These words, which so deeply surprised and moved Joseph's brothers, greatly surprised and moved the 20th century descendants of Joseph and his brothers. Verse 4 continued, "He whom you sold into Egypt." Essay, God and Free Will. Verse 5, "Now do not be distressed or reproach yourselves because you sold me hither. It was to save life that God sent me ahead of you." Now that Joseph believed his brothers truly regretted what they had done to him, he told them they were not ultimately responsible for what they did. They were actors in the divine drama that led to his prominence in Egypt. This raises one of life's most important questions. How much free will do we have? Religious people who believe in divine intervention, such as Joseph describes here, need to address this question. Atheists have an answer. Human beings do not have free will. If, as atheists contend, we are only material beings, like the stellar dust of which we are composed, we cannot have free will. As matter doesn't make choices, neither do we. Everything we do is determined by our genes and by neurons firing according to scientific principles. For the atheist, the assertion that human beings have free will is wishful thinking and self-delusion. Human beings are essentially rocks with self-consciousness, and therefore have no more free will than rocks. Here is the atheist position on free will, as described in The Humanist by a prominent contemporary atheist thinker. There's a desperate charm to that idea, free will, but we're quite beyond it now. The mechanisms of decision-making, the chemistry of empathy, the physics of neuroplasticity, Each gnaws away every day at the few remaining supports of a free will model of individuality. We are forced to either redefine free will to something existent but meaningless, or chuck the idea altogether, and make peace with finding the subtle joys of our exquisite programmability. But this position makes sense only in the abstract. When any of us, atheists, believers, agnostics, think about it, the idea we have no more free will than a rock strikes us as absurd. If you decide to forego dessert to keep your weight down, is that decision entirely programmed? Do students who cheat on tests have no choice but to do so? Are we to believe that no one who does good and no one who does evil is in any way responsible for what they do? If we do believe these things, all discussion of good and evil is meaningless. Calling a person or an act evil is no more meaningful than calling the earth evil after an earthquake. And moral instruction is pointless. We will respond to such instruction as we are programmed to. So why teach good and evil? And if teaching about good and evil does influence people, it means we do have free will. Finally, if there is no free will, life is pointless. We are all acting out a pre-programmed script we had no hand in writing. Only if we have non-material consciousness and/or a soul can we make decisions that are not entirely determined by genes and environment. Therefore, as ironic as it may sound to a secular person, only a God-based understanding of human life allows for free will. The problem for believers is how to believe in both divine intervention and free will. If Joseph was right about God leading the brothers to abandon him to his fate in a pit, where was the brothers' free will? There is no perfect answer, because believers are not prepared to abandon either belief in divine intervention or free will. But there are imperfect answers. One is that moral free will and divine providence coexist, but only God knows precisely how they mesh. Another is most believers recognize God does not always intervene, but does so at times of his choosing for his purposes. I find both responses rationally acceptable. In any event, Joseph was magnanimous in telling his brothers not to reproach themselves for what they did to him. But it is quite a bit easier, we must admit, to forgive and to see God's hand when things turn out as well as they did for Joseph. Verse 6. It is now 2 years that there has been famine in the land, and there are still 5 years to come in which there shall be no yield from tilling. Verse 7. God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival on earth and to save your lives in an extraordinary deliverance. Joseph's statement reflects Maimonides' view, a view shared by many, if not most, believers, that on occasion, God intervenes in human affairs and uses human beings as vehicles to carry out his plans. Verse 8. So, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all his household, and ruler over the whole land of Egypt. Verse 9. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me without delay. Verse 10. You will dwell in the region of Goshen, where you will be near me, you and your children and your grandchildren, your flocks and herds and all that is yours. Verse 11. There I will provide for you, for there are yet 5 years of famine to come, that you and your household and all that is yours may not suffer want. Verse 12, you can see for yourselves, and my brother Benjamin for himself, that it is indeed I who am speaking to you. Verse 13, and you must tell my father everything about my high station in Egypt, and all that you have seen, and bring my father here with all speed. Verse 14, with that he embraced his brother Benjamin around the neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Joseph had special affection for Benjamin because, in addition to being his beloved mother's only other child, he was the only brother not involved in the original attack on him. Verse 15, he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. Only then were his brothers able to talk to him. To Joseph's credit, he did not only embrace Benjamin, but embraced and wept upon all his brothers. One would wish that all who read this would find it possible to reconcile with family members from whom they are estranged and whose wrongs are likely far less evil than those committed by Joseph's brothers. Verse 16. The news reached Pharaoh's palace. Joseph's brothers have come. Pharaoh and his courtiers were pleased. Verse 17. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Say to your brothers, do as follows, load up your beasts and go at once to the land of Canaan." Verse 18, "Take your father and your households and come to me. I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall live off the fat of the land." Pharaoh, indebted to Joseph for saving his kingdom from starvation, welcomed Joseph's family to Egypt to avoid starvation and live well. In other words, he wanted to do for Joseph's family what Joseph had done for Egypt. Verse 19, "And you are bidden to add, do as follows, take from the land of Egypt wagons for your children and your wives, and bring your father here." Verse 20, "And never mind your belongings, for the best of all the land of Egypt shall be yours." Verse 21, "The sons of Israel did so. Joseph gave them wagons as Pharaoh had commanded, and he supplied them with provisions for the journey." Verse 22, "To each of them, moreover, he gave a change of clothing. But to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and several changes of clothing." Again, Joseph gave Benjamin special treatment. While Joseph's preference for Benjamin is understandable, see commentary on verse 14, Joseph apparently learned little from his own experience how destructive such favoritism can be. Verse 23, "And to his father he sent the following, 10 he asses laden with the best things of Egypt, and 10 she asses laden with grain, bread, and provisions for his father on the journey." Verse 24, "As he sent his brothers off on their way, he told them, 'Do not be quarrelsome on the way.'" The Hebrew word translated here as quarrelsome, tirgazu, means get angry in modern Hebrew. The literal meaning is to shake. In biblical Hebrew, it is used to mean to fear. See Exodus chapter 15, verse 14, Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 25, 1 Samuel chapter 14, verse 15. Joseph's remark would mean, "Don't fear on the way." It is an expression of the newly repaired familial relations. Gottlieb. Verse 25. "They went up from Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan." Verse 26. "And they told him, 'Joseph is still alive. Yes, he is ruler over the whole land of Egypt.' His heart went numb, for he did not believe them." Jacob's reaction to his son's news was shock and disbelief, because the news that Joseph was not only alive and well, but also the ruler of Egypt, was literally unbelievable. Moreover, these same sons had brought him the blood-soaked tunic 20 years before, leading Jacob to conclude Joseph was dead. Though he never confronted them about it, he had to have wondered what had really happened to his beloved son and what his other sons knew about it. The brothers have reaped the inevitable consequence of lying, being doubted when telling the truth. Many adolescents and teens lie to their parents, and when their parents respond even to the truth with skepticism, they angrily protest, "You don't trust me." To which the appropriate response is, "Why should I?" Verse 27, "But when they recounted all that Joseph had said to them, And when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to transport him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Verse 28, "Enough," said Israel. "My son Joseph is still alive. I must go and see him before I die."